So, I feel like I need to print a retraction, so to speak. Do you remember our episode Cult Movies?
Is that the one where we watched all of the Keanu Reeves films?
No.
Is that the one where we watched all of the what was that called? Twilight Zone? Oh no, Twilight. Yeah. Is that what we watched?
We have never watched Twilight for the podcast. That's just something you have watched. It was the one where we watched, rather than like the cult movies that people know, like Sleepaway Camp or the Rocky Horror Picture Show, we watched their sequels, Sleepaway Camp 2, Unhappy Campers, and Shock Treatment.
I would like to remind you that Shock Treatment was not a sequel, not a prequel, but an equal.
That is accurate. And I have to make the retraction that you said you didn't think the music slapped, and I agreed with you, and I said the songs were kind of fun, but they were not things that I would be singing like 2 weeks later.
Denton is now stuck in my head, you son of a bitch.
That episode was published July 19th, 2009. So it
No.
almost a year ago.
No, that's
No,
not 2009.
2019, not 2009.
Yeah.
You're right. Sorry.
I was 19.
I can look in numbers and I still can't read them correctly. It's called, I think the scientific term for it is that I'm stupid. But do you know what I was listening to while we were doing like our summaries for the movies and stuff?
Which song?
I was listening to Shock Treatment, Little Black Dress, and Bitchin' in the Kitchen. I love the song Shock Treatment. I love Bitchin' in the Kitchen. Me of Me, Little Black Dress, and I think it's called Look What I Did to My Id. All have stayed with me in the year since we've watched this movie. So I owe it an apology. I can't. I was like, yeah, I'm not gonna be singing these like two weeks later, 2 months later, whatever I said. Like it is a year later, and Shock Treatment, I listen to it like once a month, it gets stuck in my head. So it's my retraction. I'm sorry, Shock Treatment. Maybe they were right. No, they weren't right. You're not an equal. But the music's good. The music's good. I still like it. And it just makes me wonder how it would have turned out since I think we discussed this on the episode, probably, that a lot of those songs were written for a different version of a Rocky Horror Picture Show sequel. I can't remember what the title was supposed to be now. Something like Rocky Shows His Heels or something like that. But a lot of those songs were written for that and then got like repurposed for Shock Treatment and different characters sing them and they're made into different circumstances.
The world may never know the answer to your question, Jason, because that movie doesn't exist.
It will never know. We watched Blade and Underworld for this week's movies. They are both vampire movies, but I think that's not why you picked them. I don't remember what your rationale was.
So, my rationale for this episode was that these two films specifically, and I mean, others that followed, and there probably was some before. I don't recall what order the things happened in. Blade came out in 1998, and Underworld came out in 2003. Somewhere in there, the Twilight Saga happened. Somewhere in there, you had films like Queen of the Damned. Like I said, I don't recall which one was first, but.
Queen of the Damned was definitely before Twilight.
Yeah, but I don't know which. Like. What the OG was, and don't really care because I feel like Underworld with four fucking films,
Five.
five, wow, good job, applause there. And Blade with three films wrapping up,
Four.
really?
No, I'm just kidding. That one I'm fucking with you on.
Okay. I was just gonna say, wrapping up with fucking Jessica Biel playing an archer really just quintessentialized basically 2000s culture. They set it up and made an entire decade, if you will, of culture. So that's why we watch these two movies.
So I think I would argue, without looking it up, that a lot of this trend started with the Interview with a Vampire that I believe had Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt in it.
Is that pre or post Scientology?
So it's 1994, so I feel like that would be right in like the beginnings of Tom Cruise Scientology.
Mm. And I mean, that is the Queen of the Damned, like, to me, even though it was before Queen of the Damned.
Well, Queen of the Damned is technically a sequel to that, correct?
It is, because the book is a sequel to the other book. They're in the same book series.
Oh, and that is the third book in the series. I didn't realize that they skipped a book.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was going to say, was I thought there was a book between them, but having never read them, I think I tried once and was just like, no. It's kind of like Les Mis, where I couldn't make it past the second chapter, and I had to be like, I'm going to stop. Oh, the second book is called The Vampire Lestat, and they did, in fact, skip that. Which is kind of weird.
Well, it looks like they said that that combined a lot of elements into The Queen of the Damned, which sometimes that can work, because I was a big fan of... Did you ever watch the sci-fi channel miniseries of Dune?
No, I did not.
So it was really good. I feel like for when it came out, it probably looks like bullshit now. But they followed that up with a Children of Dune miniseries that combined Dune Messiah and Children of Dune into one miniseries, rather than doing a Dune Messiah miniseries and then a Children of Dune miniseries. And I think it worked out a lot better that way.
Yeah, that makes sense, because you should stop reading after probably the third book.
Yes, yes, definitely. Because, did you read all of them?
Yeah.
You read all the ones, right? Even the Brian Herbert ones?
Yeah, my brain can't ever have that space back. It's permanently burned in there, and it doesn't pay any rent. I'll tell you that. There's no rent paid by Super Quizrak Cataract Duncan, Idaho, with the Super Gola Jessica Bean Gesserit Mother Witch thing. It's...
Do you call them Bean Gesserits?
Yeah, I did.
I think that's racist. I think that's an offensive term to Mexican Reverend Mothers.
I really thought you were going to say legumes. Just all legumes. Peanuts will rise up against me.
Man, those books were so good. I think that Dune, Dune Messiah, and Children of Dune are incredible and really work together in a way that all three books feel like they were just written as one giant book, like one really continuous story that flows so seamlessly. And then, like, the older Frank Herbert got, the more he just wanted to put sex into the books. Like, I think it's the fourth one, God Emperor of Dune.
Yeah, he just wasn't having any, so he had to write about it. He had to get it out somehow.
I think that's one where, like, God Emperor Leto Atreides, it turns out that, like, he uses an all-female army, and his Duncan Idaho Gola sees that, and it's like there's implied lesbian sex in, like, the dormitories, and he says it's, like, good for them to get their energy out or something. And then the next book introduces, I think, the Honored Matres that, like, control men by having sex so good with them they're hypnotized. And that, like, book culminates in the Duncan Idaho Gola, like, somehow knowing their techniques and having sex with that Honored Matres so good that she's hypnotized by him, but they're, like, hypnotized by each other because they are, like, having the absolute best sex. And you're just sort of like, what the fuck am I reading?
Yeah. If you haven't pressed stop yet, that's because you're listening to these two motherfuckers talk. And in case you
you're welcome.
Don't remember, I'm Hutch.
And I'm Jason.
And this is Real Trouble Podcast. When vampires are no longer fiction and instead walk among the humans of the world, hidden in plain sight, one vampire, probably actually a dampier, but that's a deeper discussion.
Fucking nerd.
Stand alone against the rising tide. His mission is to wipe the mother-murdering vampire scum from the face of the earth, but falls into some feelings when he sees Dr. Karen Jensen get bitten by a regenerating vampire named Quinn that he just put to rest. He can't seem to let go of this one and takes her back to his secret lair and treats her with some form of garlic medicine that keeps her from immediately turning feral with the help of his fixer, Abraham Whistler, which, by the way, would be an excellent porn name. Quinn checks back in with his boss, Deacon Frost, who has an ace up his sleeve, to help him win his all-in gambit against the humans for the last time. Coming this fall. Blade.
So I love this movie starts off telling us that it is 1967, and we get this little scene of Blade's birth, and then we go to now. Like, they couldn't even bother to give us a year. And you might think, okay, well, that's not that weird. They just wanted it to feel like whatever the current time you were watching is when it could have happened. It's not like they were going to predict that everybody would have cell phones on them within the next couple of years and then smartphones not long after that, and this would feel a little dated, right? So, sure. Except for the fact that if you've watched Blade 2, you would know that despite Blade 2 coming out, and I believe it was 2002, they specifically make it in 1999, which they say is 2 years after the events of this film. And maybe that's a decision they made later. I just really enjoyed the specificity of 1967 and then just the vagueness of now.
Yeah, that really doesn't make any sense because actually, in the film, Whistler is talking about how while vampires have a timeless body that time doesn't touch, which is what timeless generally means, and the fact that Blade actually ages like a human, they could have put an actual year on it, but instead chose not to. And they also included this line about him aging normally. They really should have just let that one go.
I didn't even think about that, but you are totally right. Since they tell you that, you have a rough idea of when this movie must take place.
Yeah.
The other thing that immediately jumped out to me, and I won't lie, I'm not even 100% sure.
Was it Willem Dafoe's confusingly large penis?
There's a character, Raquel, and it's actually the woman that leads the man to the bloodbath rave.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like, I only noticed this because I noticed her name in the credits, but that was Tracy Lords.
I don't know who that is.
For those of you who are unfamiliar with Tracy Lords,
that's me.
Was a pornographic actress in the mid-80s who is somewhat famous for the fact that she used a fake license to start her porn career, so she was actually, like, 15 or 16 when she started, not 18, and then later transitioned into mainstream movies. She recorded a song, Love Never Dies, for the movie Pet Sematary 2 in 1992, so I was just surprised she was in this movie.
They made a second Pet Sematary?
I didn't know that till now, but yes, apparently there's a Pet Sematary 2 that came out in 1992.
Oof.
So that cracked me up when I saw her name. I was just like, wait, Tracy Lords is in this movie? And she actually got billing in this movie, despite just being the seductive vampire that leads that guy to the blood rave, and then is not seen again the rest of the movie.
You know, we watched another film that was like that.
That had a former porn actress that got a billing in the title for one scene?
No, it wasn't quite as disastrous as having the hedgehog. I mean, Ron Jeremy playing it like Boondock Saints. Although he did have a much more long-standing role than a solid 5 minutes. But we watched Bad Times at the El Royale.
Yeah.
Which had Nick Offerman in it for a solid 5 minutes. And then he got killed. And you're like, they could have used fucking anybody. But they brought Nick Offerman in just to play this throwaway role.
What about the fact that we learn that Blade's name is Eric, but we don't learn it until his mother calls him it.
Right?
So it's very disjarring.
And it's just like, wait, his name was fucking Eric? Why was his name Eric? And how did you name him when you died and he was taken from you and or died? Were you just like, this is what your name should have been?
And he has a very strong reaction to it. So clearly he knew that he was Eric. But I'm with you. If she died, like, was that her final dying words? Was like, name that baby Eric.
Yeah, that's really fucking weird.
Give him a heroic name. Call him Eric.
Which is so dumb, because you've got another character named Abraham Whistler. Just fucking name him something like anything. Deacon Frost.
All the names in this movie are terrible, other than Blade.
I thought they were referring to him as, like, Deacon. I thought they were calling him, like, Brother Frost. But they were that's his fucking name is Deacon. I thought that the only person named Deacon is potentially also an android in Fallout 4. It's definitely an android.
Interestingly, speaking of, like, names, I noticed that Stephen Norrington, who directed this movie, had a cameo as Michael Morbius, which people may be familiar with as a Spider-Man villain that Jared Leto is set to play in a movie that's supposed to come out next year, but the scene was cut. Because speaking of these weird names, I guess is the reason it made me think of it, is I assume a lot of these names were taken straight from the Blade comic, but I don't know. I noticed that they only gave Marv Wolfman a creator credit for Blade and for Deacon Frost rather than just the property Blade. So I've never read any of the Blade comics, so I don't know if Abraham Whistler.
I think so, just because even though I'm not involved in comic books at all and I think superheroes are kind of dumb, I actually recognize the name Whistler.
Well, you probably just know it from Whistler's mother.
Whistler's mom has got it going on.
It's funny to me that this is a comic book movie, because I don't think this is the movie that you necessarily would think of as being a comic book movie, especially if you're not familiar with comic books. But it has such, like, telltale signs of 90s comics in this. Like, there's the shot when he leaves the bloodbath and it's just the streets are completely empty with like a million newspapers flying everywhere. Mm-hmm. And then there's a similar scene when they pull up to what ends up being like the archives, when he pulls up there with Dr. Karen Jensen and they pull up in the car and it's like in a dark alley and, you know, like the black muscle car, and there's again like newspapers flying everywhere and posters on the signs. Like, it's very 90s comic book style to it. It looked like a comic book from that sense. And I thought the same thing with the color palette they used. Like, the way they did the color correction on the film stock, you know, gave it like a lot of darker hues and stuff. And I thought it fit really well. Like, I really liked the overall look of this movie, despite the fact that it aged really poorly. I mean, I think basically everything from this era did. Not The Matrix, honestly, as much as I would have thought. But their effects were used a little bit differently. You know, that was more like literal wire foo of people on wires and them taking shots from multiple angles and stuff. There weren't really like a ton of CGI characters in The Matrix. Like, in this, I feel like when anybody would evaporate,
explode,
yeah, they looked friggin' awful. Or when those people's like out of their mouths and their skins peeled out, but out of their like skeletal skull, smaller skeletons with wings flew out of them.
Oh yeah,
that looked, a lot of this movie looks like hot garbage, you know, 22 years later.
That being said, the like opening scene where they pull in, they go in the club in the back of the meat freezer and everyone's vibing to Confusion at the bloodbath, that's it's a really cool scene in the bloodbath, which the name of that is not lost on me. It's very ironic in the sense that they take an actual bloodbath to this song, but also then Wesley Snipes comes in, total badass motherfucker, and kills a lot of vampires. It's what you would call a bloodbath.
Do you feel like every movie in this era that was an action movie felt like it had to have a scene at a rave? Like, I think raves had just become something that surfaced in popular culture, people knew about. Like, even think about The Matrix. Like, Neo's at that weird rave he follows the White Rabbit to, and that's where he meets Trinity for the first time. Like I said, I really feel like raves were probably already happening like probably since the 80s, I would think, when electronic music got big, but it seemed like it reached the general like public awareness that it was a thing, and it was like underground, so it was cool. So like they just started shoving it in like every action movie.
Yeah, they definitely did that. The fashion in this film is very like 1990s, 2000s as fuck.
Oh yeah. You see a lot of midriffs on the ladies in this.
A lot of midriffs, a lot of like PVC, a lot of leather, some weird fucking sunglasses, a lot of weird fucking sunglasses. It is very dated. It's almost a period piece, even though they just say now. Maybe to them it's very futuristic, but it is not futuristic.
No. His gun is super weird, though. Like, it's like a handgun that's converted into being like half of an Uzi.
Oh, it's like a Temp or a Tech 9 or some similar like machine pistol, which you actually see in Underworld as well.
Yes.
She's got a machine pistol, which fires like 1,000 rounds of it before it needs to be reloaded, but it's always at like a very crucial time that it needs to be reloaded.
Yeah, but his is so much larger and bulkier. Like I said, it really, you're not wrong. I mean, it's obviously, it doesn't look like a Tech 9 because it loads very differently and stuff. But yeah, it just has that Uzi, weird Uzi. It looks like a Glock that someone strapped an Uzi front on. And it's just very strange to me. It's also strange to me when Whistler uses it to supposedly kill himself towards the end of the movie and it fires a single shot. And you think would think from the way that he was using it earlier that would be like...
Well, some guns have selective fire modes. I don't think that was one, but it must have for just that shot.
That's fair, maybe. It's got a single shot, 3-round burst, and full auto. Yep. And they never used any of those, except...
The blade just kicks it on full auto.
Except for that one time.
It's actually chain-fed out of his coat sleeve. That's why he has to wear that leather coat. Man, another thing that is really cool to me and almost feels like a period piece and didn't really actually feel that dated. It's just something that happened in a lot of films at the time. The effects were fine. Was the fight in the archives with all that fucking glass.
You feel like you said you feel like that's not dated?
I feel like that's not dated in the sense that like the effects are awful because the effects were, I would practical. Assume, practical effects. Yeah, yeah. Smashing, what is that actually called? Sugar glass or sugar plate?
I don't remember.
It's basically just a big fucking window made out of, like, sugar. But, like, that effect stayed cool. It didn't, like, look goofy or anything. But that whole, like, fight sequence, fight series, fight style happened a lot in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Yes. No, you're totally correct. I feel like John Wick brought that a little bit back in the third one, if I'm thinking, and maybe the second one too. The second one, they had kind of the mirror fight, right? With Ruby Rose. And I think the third one, there's a little bit of a glass fight. And I think one of the James Bonds, I want to say Skyfall, one of the current James Bonds, they had a fight in like an all kind of glass room, which are a little bit more contemporary. But you're right, I feel like that style felt the period it was. One thing that I feel like does not feel dated at all and feels very contemporary is that when Blade is confronted by the police officers at the morgue / hematology department of the hospital, he has Dr. Karen Jensen, a doctor that works there, in his arms, and while he is running away, the police officers keep trying to shoot a black man and this black woman in the back while they're not returning any fire or doing anything that could put any of the police officers in resistance, and they have like 15 cops just trying to shoot them.
Yeah, like, oh my god, that is very apropos of the times.
And what I also thought, I was like, she's a hostage. Like, you guys are literally saying, we find out from that other cop that, yes, he's corrupt, but we find out that co-workers reported her as being kidnapped. And then if you know this guy is snatching a doctor, why would you be opening fire on him while he has that person in his hands? Like, these are the worst fucking police officers ever.
Yeah, one of them even pulls out, like, a M16 or Armalite 10 or whatever, and starts shooting at them from, like, really far away. That's clearly just putting the hostage in significant danger. Why would you do that? That is bad policing.
I did like the last shot of them getting shot at by the police. They open some kind of cover. It looked like maybe some kind of electrical cover, HVAC cover, something that gets shot with multiple rounds. And the way they did the effect looked nothing like the way a bullet hitting metal would look.
Yeah.
But it looked very comic-y. And I did like the visual style, even though it was very inaccurate. It was like the bullet made a very circular hole, but it also dented like larger than a golf ball size cup that was perfectly round and took all the coloring off of it, making it aluminum.
Like flaked all the paint off.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, that while that looked nothing like what shooting a bullet through any of that would do, I did think the effect itself was very cool, and that looked like something you might see in a comic panel. So I actually really enjoyed that stylistically.
You know, something else that was very, like, stylistic and very much so like a period piece that, again, aged well. The effects weren't bad or anything. And we actually see it in the other film we watch as well, is a fight in a fucking subway. Like, have you ever ridden the subway, being from New York?
Yes, I've ridden the subway many a time.
How many gunfights have you gotten in on the subway?
None, actually.
Oh, took you a really long time to arrive at that number.
Yeah.
But in these two films that we watched, we're 2 for 2.
Well, that, you know, it's funny. Like, you can almost pick, like we were saying, different scenes that go into different eras of stuff.
Yeah.
Because the 90s, I feel like, had a lot of subway fights, too. The Matrix, yeah. They have the fight not on the subway, but on the subway platform that ends up throwing Agent Smith in front of it. Speed ends with the fight between Keanu and Hopper on the subway that ends with them on top of the subway. I think there's at least a couple more movies where they end up in a subway fight as well. Don't they in one of the Die Hards, and in Spider-Man 2 they end up on a fight in a subway? Die Hard with a Vengeance, don't they have a subway fight?
I've never seen that film. Okay. I'm sure that comes as a shock to you. I think I've seen, obviously, Die Hard. But I've never seen Die Hard with Vengeance.
Okay. I think it's that one. I'm pretty sure one of the Die Hards, they have a subway fight sequence.
Is that before or after the, you know, run-of-the-mill beat cop from New York City turns into a superhuman?
That's during.
Okay.
I feel like he's much more of a superhuman in Die Hard 4. It's ridiculous. Like, in Die Hard 4 is the one where he, like, takes out a helicopter with a cop car by, like, jumping it.
Wow.
And I didn't bother seeing Die Hard 5.
That's borderline Fast and Furious level.
No. I think there's none of those. Plus the Hobbs and Shaw movie.
Stop it.
Fast and Furious Presents.
Stop it.
Yeah.
So you were talking about this earlier, and I agree with you about the, like, aged practical effects of this film. Or not practical effects, rather. The CGI was terrible.
Yeah, that's how I know that they use sugar glass or whatever for those, because you would have been able to tell if it was fake glass, because, like, the blood at the end of the Blood God ceremony.
Oh, that's what I was going to say. The fucking Blood God scene, period, looks like it could have been out of the fucking Ghostbusters movie. Like, those bat skeletons could have easily been fucking the Slimer ghost.
Yeah, I feel like I could make those effects now on my computer.
Yeah.
And you would be like, Jason, that looks completely like shit. And I'd be like, yeah, that's good enough for Blade.
I think what, like, used, at least to me, this film and, you know, Interview with a Vampire, like you said earlier, and several other films in the same style that springboarded the success of, like, the vampire and werewolf culture into things like Twilight and fuck, I feel like there's 1,000 things I don't know about them, and that's okay. that's okay to not know about them. I don't want to know about the majority of things that go on. But I feel like is quintessential in Karen's sexual experience getting bit by Blade. She's just like, don't stop. And that is not very much her being exsanguinated as much as her getting dicked down on.
That seductiveness, you know, has always been a trait of vampires, even back to the original Dracula book. But it manifests itself in very strange ways in this movie to me.
Yeah.
The biggest one being when Blade is getting set up for the Blood God ceremony, and his mother seems like she's almost ready to make out with him. Like, she's rubbing her nose against his chin and kind of, like, whispering to him.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, she is... She's DTF.
I mean, she's saying at that moment, though, like, your mother died a long time ago.
And I've done bad things and I enjoyed them.
Yes. And Blade is just like, Mama.
Yeah, she's like, I've killed people, I've, you know, eaten people, whatever, and I enjoyed the whole thing. I'm like, yeah, but incest seems a little bit weird. It's like, let's not go this route right now.
He about to die.
Did you realize when you saw her in that first coffin bed scene that that was the same woman that played his mom?
No.
I didn't either.
Didn't even hit me. Didn't hit me like the first time, the second time, until it opened up. And I actually thought it was going to be Dr. Karen Jensen. And then I was like, who's that? And then she was just like, Eric. And I was like, what the fuck is happening?
Yeah, when she got out, when he's in the room... I thought it was going to be the type of thing where it was going to look like she was coming onto him and then she would try to kill him and he'd have a fight with her, like a, you know, like kung fu her.
Yeah.
And then she was, like you said, she was like, Eric. And I was like, what? I was like, is that his mom? I was like, nah, I'd be stupid as fuck. And then he's just like, what? And she's like, Eric. And he's like, I thought you were dead. And I was like, oh, it is his mom.
How bizarre.
One thing we kind of touched on this that didn't age that well and does date this movie, but I think this happens in anything that is not intentionally a period piece, is we said, like, the fashion, like all the leather and all the outfits of people wearing. Deacon Frost looks like a complete fucking douchebag as soon as you see him. Like, the hair, the clothes he wears, he just looks like a fucking low rent Backstreet Boy.
Except he has, like, milky white eyes.
Except for his milky white eyes. Didn't Joey Fatone have milky white eyes?
At least once.
Okay. My favorite Backstreet Boy, or member of NSYNC, I don't know which.
You just liked him because his name was Joey, and you know a lot of good Joeys?
Can I just say he's my favorite because he's the only one I remember? Justin Timberlake. Justin Timberlake was one of the two, also, actually, wasn't he?
I think he was with NSYNC, but I don't know.
I'm confident that he was either in NSYNC or the Backstreet Boys. I'm very confident about that. I know he wasn't in 98 Degrees.
I was about to throw that. I don't know anyone that was in 98 Degrees.
One year for Christmas.
You got a Nick Lachey CD?
No. My Aunt Sandy and her husband Michael got my brother and I CDs. I can't remember how old we were. But it must have been the year that we went to a concert. Like, I think this is the first, like, concert I went to that wasn't, like, kids' music or anything with my parents. And it was, I cannot remember who opened, but then it was Blood, Sweat, and Tears and Three Dog Night. And I fucking really enjoyed it. Clearly an old people concert, but we went with my parents. So they got me a Three Dog Night CD because I liked, you know, the song Jeremiah Was a Bullfrog.
Yeah.
So I got a Three Dog Night CD probably around like fifth or sixth grade. So my brother, who would have been around seventh or eighth grade, they got a 98 Degrees CD that never got opened. Like,
oof.
That sat in the CD case still in plastic until my parents got rid of that stuff when we moved.
Dear God.
I was just like, why do they think he would want this? Man, watching this, I was like, the writing is so cheesy, and a lot of the acting is so hammy.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what's funny about that? This used to be comic book movies. And this was like a good comic book adaptation of a movie. We didn't get Iron Man, which I think like started the trend of like the more modern take on like comic book movies, doing them a little bit more serious. Not that Wesley Snipes was a star when he did this.
Yeah.
So it's not like you didn't have stars doing these things, but like I feel like getting full star-studded casts for the movies. You know, like Captain America is, I would actually say Chris Evans wasn't as famous when he did it, but Hugo Weaving was the bad guy. And Jeff Bridges is the bad guy in Iron Man.
Right.
Obviously, as those became more successful, you got people like Benedict Cumberbatch being Doctor Strange and stuff like that. Like, people that, like, the biggest name at the time hop on to do one of those things. But anyway, like, they weren't, like, there was a different level of what you'd accept from a movie then and now. Like, if you made this movie now, even with the same, like, or with the updated effects, like, it would be terrible. Like, you would compare this to other movies that have been adapted from a Marvel property, and you would be like, the writing is so bad. Like, some of the performances, like Nebushi Wright, I don't know how you pronounce that, who is Dr. Karen Jensen, like, she's not very good in this. I don't think Kris Kristofferson was that great in it. Donald Logue, who is funny to me, however how many things, that weird things I see him in, feel like he was in Sons of Anarchy for a bit, if I remember correctly, and other stuff, I just think of him as the dad in Grounded for Life, is like what I always think of him as. But like, I feel like he's a little bit hammy in this. Anyway, like I'm saying, like, it's just such a different standard. And I think one of the best things that exemplifies this is when Blade is fighting Deacon Frost after he has been possessed by the Blood God or whatever, and he says he's not Deacon anymore, that Blade kills him by this stuff that, injecting him with stuff that like breaks apart hemoglobin, so like the blood can't bond or whatever.
Yeah.
And after he sticks him with like a million of them, he takes the last one, flips it up in the air, and then kicks it, which makes it fly straight into his forehead. And do you remember what his line is, like what his one-liner is after he like kills him?
No, actually I don't recall.
He says, some motherfuckers are always trying to ice skate uphill. What does that have to do with the whole rest of the fucking movie?
Yeah.
And then the movie ends, setting us up for a possible sequel by having Blade kill a vampire in Russia.
Yeah.
Why? If you wanted to set it up for a sequel, why didn't you just do it in any fucking alley? Why is he specifically in Russia? Is it, this used to be comic book movies. Now you're getting stuff like Joker, which is getting nominated for an Academy Award.
That doesn't make any sense at all, because he says in the film, how do you think we finance this operation?
Yeah, stealing watches off the cop he beats up.
Yeah, so he beats up a cop, steals a watch, and that's like how he buys whatever the fuck. He uses like silver bullets, so like that's gotta be expensive. But then he just catches a plane to Russia? I can't imagine he flew economy. But maybe he did.
To be fair, this was pre-9/11, so he could probably just pack all of his guns and his sword in, like, his carry-on. And as long as he didn't take it out of overhead, he was probably fine.
He probably flew in a Concorde jet, too.
Oh, man. I lived on the beach growing up, and it was near and like an airport. Like, we were sort of over, the beach was over the line, and I kind of always loved when the Concords, you'd see them go by.
Supersonic flight.
And obviously they could only go by over the water, because I think they really weren't allowed to fly over residential areas, because sometimes they kind of break windows and shit.
Yeah.
But they're so cool, because they look like space shuttles.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man. Wish I had gotten to ride on one. That would have been an experience.
R.I.P. Concords.
Underworld is a 2003 vampire versus werewolf romance action movie by director Len Wiseman. Kate Beckinsale stars as Celine, an elite vampire werewolf hunter known as a death dealer. While out hunting lichens, Celine realizes they are chasing a seemingly ordinary medical student, Michael Corvin. When she goes to investigate Michael Corvin, played by Scott Speedman, she runs into the leader of the Lycans, Lucian, who was long thought to be killed by the vampire Kraven. Lucian is able to bite Michael before they escape. Celine decides to prematurely wake Victor, one of the vampire triumvirate, despite it not being his turn to rule the coven. She then is able to capture the Lycan scientist, who reveals that Michael is descended from the common ancestor of vampires and Lycans, which means he may be able to become a hybrid. While she's doing this, the Lycans capture Michael. Celine goes to rescue him and ends up biting him to stop him from going full Lycan. This turns him into a hybrid, which Victor decides to kill while revealing that he killed Celine's family and his own daughter for falling in love with Lucian. Celine and Michael fight Victor before Celine kills him and they run away together.
I've been waiting that whole summary just to say that Celine's liking her some Michael.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. High five.
It's a long summary.
I feel like a lot happens in that movie, and I didn't want to... I had a hard time figuring out what could be left out to have an understanding of what we were talking about, or going to be talking about.
Both of these films that we watched are very lengthy, and I didn't realize that because I've actually never seen both of these films. I'd never seen either of them.
I saw Blade 2 in theaters in, I guess, 2002, I think, when that came out. I saw Blade 3 at a friend's birthday party and in theaters. I'm not sure about that, but I saw Underworld in theaters in 2003 when it came out. And oddly enough, having seen Blade 2 and Blade Trinity, I had never seen Blade. So this was the first viewing for that. Underworld, I saw in theaters. Underworld is the first movie, I believe, that I purchased myself as a teenager on DVD. And I have a fond memory one year of...
Kate Beckinsale.
Of my mom, actually, who surprisingly does not like to party on New Year's Eve, as my mom is very much a partier. One year, she wanted to stay home, and my dad kind of wanted to go out, so she was like, well, why don't you just go out? Like, some of our friends are having a party, and she's like, I don't like to go out on New Year's Eve, but you go out. Like, go out, have a good time, like, you know, whatever, have fun. And she was like, and that even works out better, because if you want to come back, I think she dropped him off and picked him up so he could get drunk and not have to worry about getting back. Because they lived in our neighborhood. It wasn't like, it was like a far drive. It was like maybe 10 minutes. But my brother was at college and visiting with friends of his. Actually, it was my brother's friend's parents that my dad was going over to. My brother might have gone with them. I don't remember. But anyway, my mom and I were home for New Year's Eve. And even though I feel like I was like 17 or 18, my mom had owned a bar at one point and is very good at making cocktails. My mom made us cocktails and we decided to watch a movie together, and I picked...
What is your mom not good at?
And I picked this movie because I was excited to show it to my mom because I like this movie so much. So we watched Underworld together. So I have fond memories of this movie. And it's really funny watching this movie again because I haven't watched it in probably 10 years. And I love this movie. Part of it, like you said, I mean... In 2003, I was in, like, 8th grade, I'm pretty sure, when I saw this movie. I think I graduated high school in 2006. So when this came out, was around freshman year or something like that. I don't know. I could figure it out. But it actually came out in September of 2003, so I guess I would have probably just...
Yeah, that actually seems right, because I would have been in 7th grade.
So I think I was in... I'm sorry, sophomore. I think it was a sophomore when I saw this. But anyway, I feel like it's just hard to also separate this movie out too as like a young teenage boy and Kate Beckinsale and all that leather, to be honest. I mean, she's so hot in this movie. And I feel like as a teenager, it's like my wife hates the Tomb Raider movies with Angelina Jolie.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they're terrible movies. But I saw those in theaters as well, and Angelina Jolie was so hot in them, and there were so many unnecessary sexually charged scenes in them, like when she talks to like one guy and he's in the shower or something like that, and you know, like it's not like there's full frontal nudity for him, but like he's clearly naked while he's having like this conversation with her, and she's kind of like, I feel like they just unnecessary sexual energy that like seeing that Yeah, that came out in 2001. So being like middle school when I saw that, I feel like the same kind of thing. I feel like I liked that movie a lot because she was really hot in it and it was an action movie. Like, it's a terrible movie. The Tomb Raider movie, mm-hmm. that is. And Cradle of Life, they're both awful. But they were 2001 and 2003. I was a teenager and there was a hot woman in them shooting guns. Like, I feel like, how was I not going to like that movie?
Right. You were set up to fail.
Yeah, I feel like what that brings me to say is the only thing I can say about this movie, Underworld, is that rewatching it, I don't think this movie's very good in a lot of aspects of it. Like, this is Romeo and Juliet plus The Matrix plus Vampire the Masquerade, is what I wrote down. They were actually sued by the White Wolf Inc., claiming that the settings were too similar to Vampire the Masquerade and Werewolf the Apocalypse in their World of Darkness settings, as well as by Nancy Collins, who wrote the Sonja Blue novels. I've never read a Sonja Blue novel, so I can't really comment on that. They didn't really seem like they were that similar.
Then why is Victor's daughter named Sonja?
Yeah, I did notice that, though. You are 100% right about that. But that was like a... My understanding is like vampire detective novels, but apparently Nancy Collins also wrote a script or a story entitled They Love Monsters, which White Wolf published, and they filed a confidential settlement with those people. So, and Blade, the guy that created Blade for Marvel, by the way, sued Blade to get that credit, and they gave him no money, and they gave him no creator credits in the other Blade 2 films.
Ooh.
But just interestingly enough, both of these had lawsuits over them as well, and it's in like a totally different type of thing. But yeah, like this movie, it feels Vampire the Masquerade-y. It's obviously got a little bit of this Romeo and Juliet kind of thing going on once he gets bitten by the werewolves, because it's like feuding clans and all this stuff. And even in Lucien and Sonja's relationship, you know, like the two feuding clans and them being in love. And then all the action scenes are so inspired by The Matrix. Like, you were talking about the guns she uses at first, those auto pistols. I think that that's very similar to a gun Neo uses. Maybe the same one he's using in the subway fight sequence, where she uses those in a subway fight sequence.
Does Neo also shoot the floor, and spin in a circle, and fall through the floor?
No.
Because that's ridiculous. That's some ridiculous shit.
I like the lore of this movie. The lore of this movie is really fun to me. I like the way they set up all this stuff with like the vampire triumvirates, and the coven leader sleeps for 100 years or whatever it is, and then the next one takes over for 100 years and the next one. But like Victor fighting the hybrid at the end of the movie is a really, really poorly done action sequence. I feel like several of the action sequences are poorly done. Aside from the fact that, obviously, it being 2003, the graphics in this hold up slightly better than Blade, but only slightly.
Yeah.
But that is all my way of saying that I feel like you will have to be the one to do more a more thorough review of this. Because watching this movie made me be like, man, this movie's not very good. I absolutely fucking love this movie. The last thing I wrote down about this movie, too, is like, the scene in which Victor reveals to Celine that he killed her family and that he killed his daughter and he did it for the blah, blah, blah. And she's kind of the look on her face. My last point is Kate Beckinsale is a legit actress. Fight me. She's so good in this movie. And I don't just mean because she's like hot in a bunch of leather. Like, I feel like she's like a real actress, like much better actress than Wesley Snipes as an actor. Like, I feel like Celine has real emotions and like it's vulnerable at points in this movie.
Yeah, she plays it close to the vest at a lot of points, but she does have real emotions that she lets down once in a while.
And I think that actually makes it better, is that because she's such a hardened death dealer, and in all this stuff, it's like she does play everything so close to the vest. When you kind of see those moments with Michael or with Victor or stuff, I think that it is like really makes them a little bit more powerful. Yeah. And like I said, I love this movie. It's not very good. I actually saw that it has a 31% approval by critics. Roger Ebert said, "This is a movie so paltry in its characters and shallow in its story that the war seems to exist primarily to provide graphic visuals." Yeah, yeah. I mean, and I'm like, yeah, kind of. 5 stars.
So, yeah, I wrote a lot of the same things down, except that I didn't see this film. This is the first viewing of this film, and, you know, whatever. I thought it was ridiculous that they put her in an old school fucking BMW car. Out of all of the cars to put her in, why would you buy whatever BMW that was, slap her in it like it was a cool fucking car, and then basically destroy it right after she picks up Michael and is like, shut up and hold on and we'll be fine. And then she literally drove it to the fucking ocean. As soon as she did that, she dropped a gear and then just put it in the ocean.
You know, one thing I have to say, sort of like talking about that, is as much as like this also had a similar color palette to Blade and stuff like that, do you notice that neither one of these movies has, at least I thought so. Did you really think either of these movies had like any scenes that had like really some defining cinematography or shots? Because no. I didn't think so. They're so bland from that perspective.
It's almost like London in the sense that everything is just gray. In these films, everything is just dark. And the one like defining thing in almost every scene is there is some color, but it's not anything that's like as awesome as like, say, fucking the Nick Cage Red Moon or whatever it was.
Mandy?
Mandy. I was just talking about the scene where the Red Moon and like the whole red light. That was a like very specific scene that you were like, wow, this is really fucking cool. This film had none of that.
It's even like I've even told you before, sometimes I'm just kind of inspired to pick out one shot that I think is really beautiful. And even in Punch Drunk Love, I thought there was that one shot where they're silhouetted and everything against the beach. Like,
no.
Yeah, I mean, here's my thing. That was 5 seconds in an hour and a half movie that was good. I mean, that was literally the total of what was good in that movie was 5 seconds. But while this movie, I enjoy it so much more, I don't even think there's one shot like that I would praise and be like, this is a shot that makes you be like, okay, just taking this like one frame and looking at it like that feels cinematic to me. I remember thinking and getting so excited about, like I said, watching this with my mom and showing it to her for the first time, that scene, the very end scene when Celine kills Victor and like sort of the way she slashes the sword up and then like comes flying, you know, in slow-mo after that big jump and lands in the water.
Mm-hmm.
And that like those kick-ass, you know, like heeled, knee-high strapped black leather boots and corset and stuff, and like holds up the blade. But that didn't really hold up for me on this viewing. Like, not just the effect of his head coming off looking shitty, but it didn't really, I thought I was like really under impressed with the action sequences this time around watching it. I remember them being more creative, like when I saw it the first time, or at least feeling they were.
And maybe that's the fading of time. Like, you've seen more things now. You can't be like, wow, this is really like cutting edge or anything. You're like, oh yeah, I've seen a bunch of stuff.
No, I think you're right. I think this is just another movie that tried to do some stylish Matrix-esque stuff after The Matrix was so popular. And now that other people kind of, even The Matrix, that's one of the things that was interesting to me about The Matrix sequels that are not good movies, but they didn't do a lot of the camera swirling over and doing it. Like, they didn't even always do what you expected them to do. They kind of did some more interesting things. And then you've seen now the first two John Wicks. Those are fantastic from action sequences. They're very different from The Matrix. And they're very, very cool action sequences, like gung-fu karate. That is, like, top level of action cinematography. And after you get to see stuff like that, I think it's sort of like the same thing as watching the Magnificent Seven and then going back and watching the old school Magnificent Seven and how bad the gunfights look in most old westerns. Like you said, it's just, you didn't have probably the ability from a special effects point to probably do a lot more interesting stuff and still have it look good, and you didn't have the blueprint for anything else. You just had the blueprint that The Matrix is like the biggest thing in the world, and everybody's loving it for what it did to action movies, so then most people are probably like, okay, that's cool, that's what you do, is The Matrix.
Right. And, you know, this is sort of unrelated, but it's in the same vein. You know, the whole thing with Miley Cyrus and, like, Amanda Bynes and all of those, like...
You fucking keep Amanda Bynes' name out your fucking mouth.
She she grew up well. That's all I'm gonna say is she's trying to get her feet back underneath her.
She's schizophrenic.
Yeah.
And I am absolutely in love with Amanda Bynes. I don't know if people know that about me, but I have a huge crush on Amanda Bynes. I will die on the hill that Amanda Bynes is absolutely perfect, even if she's schizophrenic. I don't care.
Bring out the Dancing Lobsters.
And she got a fucking tattoo on her face, which makes me so sad. Bring out the Dancing Lobsters. I thought you were going to liken it to like Miley Cyrus, how they both kind of went batshit crazy for a little bit.
No, I was thinking more along the lines of with like Lindsay Lohan, whatever the fuck her name is, Miley Cyrus and Amanda Bynes. Like, you basically had to one up the other people to get into the news, and you had to do fucking crazier and crazier stuff. And like Keeping Up with the Kardashians.
That's where I draw the line, though, with Amanda Bynes, because she legitimately had schizophrenia, and that's why she was doing stuff that got her into the news.
Yeah.
She didn't even really party or do much stuff until she started, like, literally having schizophrenia. Whereas, like you said, Miley Cyrus and Lindsay Lohan were just getting drunk or twerking on people or go on, like, Good Morning America and told Matt Lauer that people over 40 don't have sex or whatever, because old people don't have sex. Do you remember that?
Nope, I don't. Who's Matt Lauer?
Don't worry about him. He got canceled.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought about that. He and Megyn Kelly both. So basically what I'm trying to say is just that like the next generation after them has to do crazier and crazier stuff in order to be something that no one has ever seen before. Like at the time they were very like groundbreaking, where holy shit, like this person is crazy. And now, you know, a teenage actress can do ridiculous things like what is that girl's name? Bad Baby, Bad Barbie, Bad whatever the fuck her name is.
Oh, is she the one, the Cash Me Outside girl from Dr. Phil?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They can do all sorts of crazy shit, and it doesn't make it in the news because this generation has already existed. And basically with films, like, you're watching something that, you know, is like 20-ish years old, and several films have come out since then that have been based around the same film that this was based on, as far as, like, stylistic goes.
See, but I would argue that this film didn't push it far enough.
So, have you ever opened up the freezer and stuck your head in, pulled out a tub of ice cream, and just stuck a spoon in it and took a bite?
Yeah.
And have you ever thought about what the first person who was like, man, it would be really, really good if we put some chocolate in this ice cream? Or the first person who was like, man, I know that butter is really cool and all, but what if we made it cold and put some salt in it? Or what about the first person that was just like, man, that thing standing out in my field, what happens when I pull on its udder? Holy shit, milk comes out. You arrive at a finished product of your Rocky Road ice cream from a lot of different ingredients and a lot of different people doing a lot of different things. Like, somebody had to first figure out that vanilla was good. Somebody first had to figure out that salt had properties where you could mix it with other things. Like, somebody had to figure out that you could get milk and then you could make milk cold and all this other shit that ends up culminating into the finished product, which is films like, you know, The Matrix and films like Underworld. It's basically just a product of the times.
Well, and even to go on your example that I think is actually really good, what you're talking about putting all those ingredients together. The other thing is, like you said, somebody did that the first time, and someone probably put in too much salt the first time, or not enough salt, or other things.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't have ice cream, you had shitty tasting ice cream. And because these are things that are having these huge budgets, like Underworld is projected to have a $22 million budget, is their projected budget, right? $22 million. And it made $95 million. It was a surprise hit. Like, people are like, that's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But it had a $22 million budget, which means that, like you said, somebody was probably like, hey, if we put salt in all this butter and everything, it is pretty good. You know what else? I also like to season stuff with, like, pepper and, like, rosemary. Maybe we throw that in. And they probably downed that batch and was like, man, this is shitty. Nobody that's backing $22 million wants you to be the first one to do anything.
Yeah, that's really the thing, is that basically short of like art house indie studio stuff, like Primer. Have you ever seen another fucking movie like Primer?
No. And I mean, and you're right. Like, that's why you think like the early 90s when like Tarantino was coming out with like the Reservoir Dogs and all this stuff, but they were all done on these like shoestring budgets. Yeah. And they were doing them independently. Like you said, like independent film is generally the film that's going to try to push something new and then later it'll dribble up. But yeah, nobody wants to be the one where you say, hey, The Matrix did really well a few years ago. We want to do something completely different action-wise and go against the grain of The Matrix. Give me $22 million. Because people are like, hey, you know what? People fucking like The Matrix. You want $22 million? Fucking do what people like.
Yeah. So something that blew my mind about this film, and, you know, in so much that the last film, the cops were shooting at a hostage and a guy that was also African-American. They were shooting at two African-American people. One of them was innocent, and they're just like, whatever, if she dies, fine. In this movie, they take an African-American man with a very creepy voice, turn him into a large black werewolf, and have a vampire whip at him. And I'm just like, oh, that is wrong on a couple different levels.
I didn't even think about that, but you're probably right. That probably could have been done a little bit more sensitively.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just like, that's not good. Not just in 2020 times, but that's just not good. Why did you do that?
So if you haven't seen this, you haven't seen any of the sequels?
No, I haven't. And I honestly, after watching this film, would watch them.
I was so excited when Underworld Evolution came out because I liked this movie so much. It was fucking terrible.
I was a huge fan of, like, Resident Evil. I've seen all of the Resident Evil fucking movies.
Oh, the Resident Evil movies are so bad.
Oh, they're absolutely terrible. Absolutely terrible. And I feel like it's basically the same plot as these films. This Underworld and also, to a degree, Blade really feel like they're the same, like, plot. It's just with different things overlaid. Like, instead of, you know, vampirism and lycanthropy, you've got the T-virus.
Mm-hmm.
It's very similar. Zombies instead of vampires running around.
Blade 2 is a lot more like the Resident Evil movies, because that's got a virus that vampires can get that makes them go insane. And they can bite other vampires and turn them into, like, Reavers or Reapers or something.
Yeah, I guess I've actually seen that film.
Okay, so say there's even like a vampire that gets bit that doesn't tell them that he's been bit like everybody in one of those movies. There's always, and you know, then yeah. Like ends up attacking part of the team later. Yeah, Underworld 2 just gets ridiculous because that, I don't think there's any instances of it in this movie, but in Underworld 2, like you start getting people's memories from like drinking their blood. So like when Marcus gets released at the end, like he drinks Craven's blood and then's like, I can use computers now.
He drinks Craven's blood at the end.
At the end of this movie, you know, it shows the vampire dude's blood going into the sarcophagus of Marcus.
Yeah, that wasn't Craven, though.
He wakes up in the next one.
And actually, I thought that it was the werewolf guy.
I'm sorry, that's what I mean. Yeah, it was the werewolf scientist. Yeah, the werewolf scientist's blood goes into Marcus's sarcophagus.
But wouldn't it, like, kill him?
No. Because Marcus is the original werewolf, or vampire, it turns out.
Oh, yeah, the Corvus.
Basically, the second one starts giving you this whole lore that there were three Corvus.
They set that up in the first one.
They don't tell you about the three brothers in this one.
Yeah, they do. Because Victor is just like, yeah, blah, 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 that legend. And he's just like, that's just an old fucking folktale or something like that. And then he's like, well, actually, one of the brothers is right there. And he points at fucking
okay.
Marcus.
Okay, I think I actually missed that in this rewatching. Yeah.
They set that up because then Lucien is the other one, and this guy is descended from the third.
No, William is the other one, who isn't in this movie.
Oh, okay.
Because he is Marcus's twin brother.
Mm.
And basically, they were twins. One got bit by a vampire, or a vampire bat. One got bit by a wolf, and then one brother did not get bit at all, and that's who Michael is descended from.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the blood sleeps into Marcus and kind of makes him, like, hybrid-y, because I guess he's sort of like Michael.
Oh, okay.
if I remember correctly, but basically, like, Kraven goes to kill him and take over, and he drinks Kraven's blood, and then he's like, I can use computers now, because Kraven knows how to use computers. And then, like, Celine and Michael have a conversation with somebody, and then he, like, drinks their blood, and he's like, oh, now I know about their whole conversation, everything they learned, because I drank his blood. And I was just like, okay, this is getting ridiculous.
That seems weird, because they're talking in this film about how only elders can organize their thoughts. So is he, like, so good at reading unorganized thoughts that he knows what happens? Because Victor seems very, very lost whenever he drinks Celine's blood.
I don't know, because a lot of stuff's very confusing. Like, there's a map in Celine's blood that Victor put there in the second movie. And stuff like that. Like, it's encoded into her blood when she becomes a vampire. And then I didn't see 3, because 3 is the prequel. 3 was, I think, called Rise of the Lycans, and I believe that's, like, the story of Lucien and Sonja. And then 4 and 5 are back to Kate Beckinsale being in them, and I didn't see either of those either. I think Blood Wars just came out, like, last year.
Yeah, I did see that one film came out recently, and I was just like, holy shit, this is a bigger franchise than I knew it was.
Yeah, I hated 2. I can tell you that. I loved this movie. I still love this movie, despite now realizing it's a bad movie. I hated the second one, and I did not see the third one, or any of the other ones, actually. That now I'm kind of intrigued enough. I heard the third one was actually really good.
Well, maybe you can use the rest of your quarantine time to watch that film. I mean, that is going to be the next 6 months of your life and all.
And the third one, Rise of the Lycans, has a story by credit for Robert Orr, who is actually someone I know from going to Tennessee Screenwriters Association meetings. So I am not surprised that one's a lot better, because he was involved in it. And he is a super cool, helpful dude. And I also got to meet his now wife. She was his fiance at the time during a ScriptCom thing we put together that she was a speaker on. She used to, I don't know if it's what she still does, helps put together financial packages, like backing deals for movies. But met him because he used to go to meetings, and I just have to say that he is a super cool dude. The 2 times, I think it was, I met his fiance, she was super nice too. So it's actually kind of cool knowing someone that worked on, like, such a large franchise like this.
Yeah, that's really cool. I know no one.
Sure you know somebody.
Nah.
At the very least, you probably know somebody that is friends with John Carpenter, since you got to hang out in his ancestral cabin.
Yes, I do know people who know people.
Who know
people. Forgot about her.
Do you think people that meet people are the happiest people?
I think purple people eaters are the happiest people.
A couple episodes ago, we had friend of the podcast, Nasty Nate, on, and he did an excellent job co-hosting with us when we looked at Coming of Age Tales, American Graffiti, and Dazed and Confused. However, I thought about it, and both of those are Coming of Age Tales that are primarily centered on male characters. And I thought it would be fun if we looked at 2 2017 movies that are coming of age stories for female characters, Lady Bird and The Florida Project.
Here's the thing. We don't pay one red cent to advertise for this show. Not one. Not nary one. Tell your friends. Tell your family. Tell your dog. Especially tell your dog. About RealTroublePodcast.com. And follow us at RealTroublePod on all the socials. Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, whatever. Check out our website, RealTroublePodcast. And you'll find links to Stitcher, iTunes, Spotify, but to be real, if you're listening to this, you found us somewhere.
Our introduction is Running Fanfare by Kevin MacLeod. Our transition music is Pump Sting by Kevin MacLeod, and our outro is Sweeter Vermouth by Kevin MacLeod, all of which can be found on his website incompetech.com and are used under the Creative Commons License Attribution 3.0. You can find proper accreditation on the Webby at realtroublepodcast.com. If you're having trouble finding it, just check Alta Vista or Ask Jeeves.
Here are words that had good mouthfeel once upon a time, but ended up accidentally being uttered and got cut out.
Are you just looking up 98 degrees now?
No, could it have been Three Dog Night, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and Bo Bice?
What year would that have been?
2016, which is not accurate, but I feel like from what I Googled, apparently Three Dog Night and Blood, Sweat, and Tears must have liked each other because they fucking toured together a lot.
If you can find a tour that would have been in the mid-90s, it would be the one.
No, I'm good. I'm not that dedicated to this project.
Sorry, I was just looking at Steven Dorff. Because I was like, who was he? He was the guy that was Deacon Frost.
Who is Deacon Frost?
The bad guy in Blade.
What is Blade? Oh, shit. I think I watched the wrong movie.
I would not surprise me.
The bad guy was like Lars von Krieger. What was his actual name? God, I can't remember. His name was Leon. And I think that Rick Deckard was a former police agent and was brought to his supervisor, but like previous supervisor Bryant, and then like basically forced out of retirement.
Did you watch 7 different versions of this movie?
No, there's only one Blade Runner.
I think there's several for Blade Runners. I thought there's like the Blade Runner cut, like theatrical cut, and then like a television cut, then like a director's cut, and then like an ultimate director's cut.
I haven't ever seen anything other than just Blade Runner. I don't know which Blade Runner. Can't tell you who shot first. If you know this is a...
Do you feel like all the... You go.
I was just like, you can go.